Sam Borden, where are we starting this story?
I want to start with where I was on Tuesday morning. Tuesday morning in Santos here, which is a port city on the southern coast. It's about 20 miles or so from São Paulo.
Sam Borden is ESPN's global sports correspondent, and he has been in Brazil covering the funeral of Pelé, arguably the biggest sports star that ever lived.
Santos is this city on the ocean, and it has these channels, these canals that run through it. And on Tuesday morning, I was near what they call Canal Seis, Channel 6, and I was standing in front of Pelé's family's house, where Pelé's 100-year-old mother still lives. And there were about 3,000 people on the street in front of the house. And this crowd of thousands was waiting because any moment now, Pelé's body was making its final tour around the city. The coffin was on top of a fire truck and had left the stadium and was making its way through the city of Santos. And there are fans of Santos, the club, and they're waving these giant flags and they're singing Santos songs. And they're shouting out to Pelé's family and they're throwing roses over the fence onto the lawn in front of Pelé's family's house. And then finally, amidst all this sort of madness, the fire engine shows up. And it makes its way slowly down the street. People are literally having to be cleared away by policemen to make room for this giant fire truck to squeeze its way down this narrow street and get in front of Pelé's mother's house. And when it does, you can see his sister, relatives, the mother just barely poking her head out the window. She's not in great health. She's bedridden most days. But she looked out and saw this fire engine that had her son's casket atop it. At one point, Pablo, everybody recited the Lord's Prayer. It was a strange juxtaposition of grief and emotion. You could see it on the face of his family and on many of the fans there, but also this feeling of pride that this legend, this, you know, icon of sports, of global culture, was from here. He belonged to the world. He was a big part of so many countries, so many cultures all over the world. But he wasn't loved anywhere else the way that he was loved here. Obviously, over the last week or so, people have been saying goodbye to Pelé from everywhere on this planet. But I wanted to be here to see how the people who knew him, the people who are from where he's from, got to say goodbye to him too.
For all our obsession with the newest and greatest thing, history matters in sports. It really does, and it always has. We venerate records, we debate eras, we compare and rank and measure. And whatever your metaphor of choice happens to be, the top of some sort of pyramid, Mount Olympus, Mount Rushmore, there is no debate about the fact that Pelé belongs up at the very top somewhere. The most famous person who ever played the most popular sport on planet Earth, as he himself once acknowledged.
I am a part of the biggest family in the world, football. It is a big responsibility, of course, but this is a good gift from God.
So today, we explore exactly what Pelé did with that gift for decades upon decades, until last Thursday, when he died at age 82. The first truly global superstar in sports history, and a man who is more important and more complicated than you might realize. I'm Pablo Torre. It's Thursday, January 5th. And this is ESPN Daily.
When you're on a business trip, you know what completely goes off the rails? Your workout routine, especially when you book a hotel that doesn't have a gym. So what ends up happening is you do a few push-ups and sit-ups in your room, run around the block, or just skip it entirely. Lame. If you just stay at La Quinta by Wyndham, you'll discover there's a fully equipped fitness center at every location. Now you can wake up and power your buys and tries the right way or de-stress with some cardio. The choice is yours. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book direct at LQ.com.
Sam, it occurs to me that, like, I mean, how old are you? I'm 37. You're how old?
I just turned 44.
It feels like the people who are younger than us, Sam. I'm about to go, those kids, those damn kids. But
yeah,
like
those kids, yeah.
But it feels like those kids may not appreciate fully why Pelé is this magnitude of a person to us. And so where do you even like begin that sort of back of the soccer card summary? Like, how do you begin to explain what he meant big picture?
Yeah, it's a good point, Pablo. And it's really tough because it's a different era, right? I mean, we hear these discussions when we talk about baseball players or basketball players from, you know, a different era than sort of the modern game that is being played right now. But, you know, Pelé, he had a 21-year career. He scored 1,283 goals in like 1,367 matches.
That's a lot, by the way, for the record.
Yeah,
that's like
lot.
About as many as anyone could imagine.
I was just going to say, I mean, I don't know what the metrics, you know, expected goals would have been for him or that would say, but bottom line, he scored a ton. He scored 77 goals for the Brazilian national team. He's still the only player in history to win three World Cups. I mean, it was one of those things where when you talk about Pelé, there was a beauty, there was a strength, there was a style to how he played, but it wasn't just that artistry. He also won. I mean, he was a big game player.
Right.
You know? And so like you put those two together, yes, incredibly talented. Yes, the kind of guy who is a star, who scores the goals. He wasn't a defender. He wasn't a goalkeeper. Yes, the guy who wins championships and he's good looking. He's got a smile. He plays with flair. Like, it's one of those things where it's impossible to overstate just how big a spotlight was on this guy for so long and how he delivered in that spotlight every single time.
And that spotlight found him so early, right? I mean, we're talking about four World Cup appearances starting when he was 17 in 1958 through to 1970 with Brazil winning three of those. And all of that makes Pelé still the only player to have ever won that many World Cups.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the thing, you know, I mean, he also benefited, Pablo, from being famous at a time when technology was allowing people to become more global. I mean, he played in the first World Cup that was in color television, you know what I mean? And so he's out there scoring goals for Brazil in the yellow shirt and the blue shorts. Like, it was visually arresting, you know what I mean?
Oh, like, iconic.
Yeah, and so it was an image that became a part of like the modern day soccer. It was the beginning of the modern day soccer. It was just this incredible cauldron that led to Pelé becoming, like you said, the biggest star in the biggest sport on the planet.
Right. He was pretty much just also kind of the only soccer player that Americans could name for like decades. He was this stand-in for the entire sport of soccer in America. And I guess to do him justice, we should probably establish how it is that he started playing the game. Like, how did that part of his life start?
Yeah, it's an interesting story. You know, I mean, obviously, with sort of the modern day players, whether you're talking about Ronaldo or Messi, even Messi, who came from Argentina, his is a European story. You know, he went to Barcelona, he came up through the academy there, and he went on to become, you know, the biggest star in the world. Pelé, it's different. I mean, this is not a European story. This is a guy who came up through poverty, adversity. He was born in, you know, a very small house, a shack, basically, in Minas Gerais. He grew up in poverty. His dad wanted to be a professional soccer player, had some experience as a professional soccer player, but had his career essentially destroyed by injury. And the family fell on hard times. And to be honest, Pelé's mother didn't want him to be a soccer player.
My mother, she doesn't want to see me a soccer player because my father doesn't have too much luck. Then my mother used to say when I was young, you see your father, you know, he didn't play well, he has problems.
It's you not must a profitable
be,
career.
Yeah, you must be a teacher or a doctor, something like that. Don't play soccer.
As she saw it, it only was going to lead to hardship and failure. So it took a lot for Pelé to essentially convince his family that, no, hey, this is something I'm good at. You know, when he was 10, the mayor of Beirut, the town where he was living, they had a soccer tournament. And Pelé, he wasn't used to playing soccer in anything other than playing barefoot, but he played. He played at the stadium where Buru played, where his father had played, and Pelé was the top scorer in the tournament. And, you know, shortly after that, Santos came calling. He moved to Santos, convinced his parents that he should give this a shot. And, I mean, it's one of those things where, like, he arrived in Santos and the rest pretty much is history.
But the whole legend of him, like the moniker of him, Pelé, the name, that part is from where?
Yeah, it's funny. I'm glad that you asked about it, Pablo, because it was one of the things that I've always been curious about. And so while I've been down here, we actually, the fixer that I'm working with, he and I did a little bit of work and tried to track down a little bit of the mystery. You know, Pelé's real name is Edson. His parents actually named him after Thomas Edison and misspelled it. It's spelled E-D-S-O-N for Pelé. But the idea was that he was named after Thomas Edison. It was an inventor that was appealing to his parents. But when he was younger, he really liked this goalkeeper who played for a team in the area that he was living. And the name of the goalkeeper was Bile, Bile. And when Pelé would play, a lot of times if he made a good play or he was, you know, knocked the ball away from somebody or took the ball away from somebody, he would shout out, Bile, Bile, Bile. And the other players, as you might imagine, Pablo, kind of seized upon that the way kids do, the way, you know, people like
right.
to.
This is a kid saying Kobe after they drain like a jumper.
Exactly. And everybody seized upon it. And they started to sort of make fun of him for it. And it wasn't helped by the fact that Pelé didn't speak perfectly. And so it came out sounding a little bit more like Pelé, Pelé, Pelé. And it stuck.
When I was around 8, 9 years old, a little boy in the street, he called me Pelé. Everybody started to laugh. I don't know if it was a joking or some pronunciation wrong. I just remember a fight with him. I was in the school. I got 3 days suspended because he called Pelé. I said, hey, my name is Edson. This ugly name I don't like. And now I have to accept.
So you stuck with it, though?
Yeah. Well, now I like because it's an easy name to pronounce.
Right. It's a lot easier to recognize, I guess, throughout the world.
Pelé actually has said many times that he didn't particularly love the nickname. He thought that, you know, it wasn't necessarily like the kindest compliment to him. But it's funny because while I've been down here, we actually tried to track down a relative of Bile. Bile passed away long ago, but we did. I think we found his one of his nephews. And his nephew, Bile's nephew, told us that it's actually been an incredible point of pride because he feels like his family has this special connection to this Brazilian legend. And so as he's been watching all of the coverage of Pelé, he's been thinking fondly about his uncle.
Yeah, I mean, look, here is this guy who was so unbelievable that he turned, you know, this joke of a nickname into something that stood for what? Stylistically, Sam, would you say?
In a lot of ways, it's similar to something I often think about when I think about Messi, and that's this guy doesn't look like a superstar athlete. You know what I mean? Messi, I mean, his nickname is the flea, and it stands up because he's really tiny. But Pelé is hardly big. I mean, he was 5'8". He was, you know, not particularly broad, not particularly like imposing in any way, but he played with this jogo bonito, right? This Brazilian style, the beautiful game, clever ball control, passing. I mean, I think when you look back at some of his highlights, and the one that I love to look at is the 1958 World Cup final. In his first goal, he takes the ball on his chest trap, drops it down to his foot, flicks it up with his foot over his own head and over the defender who is on him.
Yes.
Spins around and then volleys the ball into the net. I mean, it is, you know, what do the kids say, Pablo? Put it in the Louvre? Do the kids say that? I mean, like, it is a
They used to.
It is museum quality soccer. Do you know what I mean? Like,
no, and in more modern parlance, a viral, like, trending topic of a highlight if it happened, yeah, in any era.
It is just sick. If you love soccer, it is the kind of goal that just makes you smile. And that was Pelé, you know, like he had this joy, this belief that he could make anything happen. And he often did. And I think that, you know, that was such an amazing way to stand out in that time. You know, the defense and the offense of that time was a little more staid, a little more sturdy than maybe we think of it today. The game was less fluid. The positions were more defined. And Pelé was a scorer and an artist in a time when there weren't very many of those. And I think that just elevated him to a position even higher than anybody could have possibly imagined.
Yeah, no, that moment in 58 in the World Cup where he's doing that, I can only imagine what it was like to be just like a normie soccer fan at the time who has now borne witness to, yeah, a figure who looks and plays nothing like anyone I had seen before and is basically unstoppable.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly right, Pablo. I mean, that was his introduction on the world stage. That was his coming out party in so many ways. I mean, he was a 17-year-old kid. He came out of nowhere, essentially. He scored 6 goals in that tournament, 3 in the semifinal against France, 2 in the final over Sweden. I mean, it was Brazil's first World Cup in 1958. And as you just sort of alluded to there, also, this is a black face doing it. This is a black player doing it against Europeans where there really aren't very many black faces at all. And so I think in so many ways, that 1958 World Cup was the beginning of the Pelé that we know now, that we experienced, right? That our generation experienced. That was where it began. That was where his stardom began. That was where his legend began. The interesting thing, Pablo, you know, in terms of like club teams, obviously there was a lot of interest from European club teams in bringing Pelé over to play on the continent. And so in 1961, there was so much interest that the Brazilian government said, hang on a minute, we got to keep Pelé in Brazil. They passed a resolution that declared him a non-exportable national treasure, and that's why he never played in Europe during his career.
Wait, I just need it on the record here that that resolution is better than actually being labeled the GOAT. Being a non-exportable national treasure, Sam, is to me actually the GOAT of titles. But it is also true that later, late in his career, Pelé did get exported all the way to America. And that's after the break.
Delicious meat, nutritious. In the snack that packs a real protein punch, Wonderful Pistachios, one of the highest protein nuts out there. Each 1 ounce serving has 6 grams of protein, giving you over 10% of your daily value. Trust me, I've been eating them like there's no tomorrow all week. Wonderful Pistachios also come in a variety of flavors and sizes, perfect for enjoying with your family and friends or taking them with you on the go. And you, like me, are on the go a lot. Taking the kids to school, hopping from meeting to meeting, shopping for groceries, whatever it may be. Well, the good news is, not only are wonderful pistachios a complete protein providing all 9 essential amino acids, they're also great for all your adventures. So whether you're a pistachio purist who loves cracking open every nut, or you prefer the convenience of no-shells pistachios, Wonderful Pistachios has got you covered. Grab Wonderful Pistachios and elevate your snack game today. Visit WonderfulPistachios.com to learn more. Now let's talk about the play of the week. The pressure to follow up Hypnotic and Cognac weighing heavy on the team. Hypnotic was in the cup, blue, and ready for the play. And boom, Añejo Tequila came in with a smooth assist to Hypnotic's tropical fruit finish. Shaken, strained, poured, it was green and good. The playmaking splash shifted the tempo. Another great cocktail from the Hypnotic team. Every season is Hypnotic and tequila season. Hypnotic liqueur, Bardstown, Kentucky. 17% alcohol by volume. Hypnotic reminds you to think wisely, drink wisely.
So we have been trafficking in superlatives all day here, Sam. And so I figured I might as well just throw a quote from Andy Warhol, the artist who said in the 60s that in the future, everyone will be world famous for 15 minutes. Because Warhol, it turns out, also said this: Pele is one of the few who contradicted my theory. Instead of 15 minutes of fame, he will have 15 centuries. And so that sheer tonnage of attention, that status of being the most famous man on earth, how would you say Pele handled all of that?
Yeah, I think the thing that has stood out to me the most, Pablo, this week when I've been in Brazil and Santos, is the way that people who live here that knew Pele, that knew him when he was younger, even when he was a teenager playing here, they all kind of say the same thing, which is that he clearly liked being famous.
Well, you are the most photographed, the most interviewed, the most recognized person throughout the world. Do you get tired of that after a while? I mean, too many interviews, so many photographers shooting your pictures, so many people asking for autographs. After a while, this is where you are.
No, I feel comfortable in that. Of course, it's nice when you know the people recognize what you're doing. The people like you, that's very nice.
He certainly reveled in the attention. He enjoyed it. He lived it up. He partied, all of those things. But he also was able to maintain this feeling of being a regular guy. I mean, I talked to a man named Alemão, who owns a bar right literally across the street from the Vila Belmiro Stadium where Pelé played. And Alemão talks about how Pelé would come in once a week, twice a week sometimes, even when he was playing, even when he was this big star. And he would sit there and he would drink Guaraná, because that was what Pelé always drank. And they would talk about football. And then Pelé would go next door to this barbershop that is right next to Alemão's bar. And he would see the same barber, this guy named Gigi, and he would get his haircut from Gigi. And literally for 50 years, the same routine, even after he was retired, same routine. Come into Alemão's bar, have a Guaraná, go see Gigi. I looked at Gigi's shop window when I was visiting with Alemão, and the sign that Gigi has on top of his shop, it says, Pelé's Barber. I could be yours too. So clearly, people have been trading on Pelé's name for a very long time.
Yeah, there is this entire Pelé industrial complex at this point. A Pelé industrial complex, by the way, which eventually led Pelé to do the thing that so many modern soccer players have also done since he did it, which is spend the twilight of your career in the United States. Because we're talking now about 50 years ago, long before Major League Soccer, back in the days of the now defunct North American Soccer League, the NASL, and we're talking about a team called the New York Cosmos. So why did Pelé finally decide to come to America?
Yeah, it's fascinating, Pablo, to think back to, because he came out of retirement. I mean, like, hypothetically, his career was over at that point. He had retired, but at 34 years old, he spends 3 seasons with the Cosmos, essentially in a quest to help popularize soccer in the United States. Now, obviously, that is the sort of overarching theme. Yes, I'm going to bring soccer to the United States. He also got paid a lot of money. And it was no secret that Pelé struggled with his finances a couple of different times during his career. He spent his money not so wisely on a number of occasions, nearly went bankrupt a couple of times. And so he needed the money. It was one of those things where he definitely needed the money, and he knew that he could get the money in the United States. He wasn't going to get it in Brazil, but he could get it in the United States. And so essentially he made himself into this, you know, Pied Piper of soccer. He, you know, the Cosmos went from a team that was like kind of interesting in the NASL to like the Beatles, essentially. They were playing in front of crowds of, you know, 75,000 at Giant Stadium. I think NASL attendances in the years before that barely would make it to 10,000 on occasion, you know? And that was like a good day. Yeah. I mean, Pelé's first game, he played on an artificial turf field that was spray painted green in patches to make it look like an actual grass soccer field. This wasn't a place that was, you know, a soccer country, even that we know it now. This was a place where Pelé was the name, Pelé was the draw, and soccer was sort of incidental to what he was doing.
And it sounds like he is also specifically the reason why this little seedling of soccer in America ever began to sprout.
There's no doubt, Pablo. I mean, I think, you know, if you trace back, and this is really overly simplistic, but if you trace back the rise of soccer in the United States, right? Like the attention and the excitement that we felt at the World Cup this year, and you look back a generation to the 94 World Cup, when we were kids and experienced that World Cup in 94, and now a generation later, where the parents excited about the World Cup in 2022, back it up even more. Pelé in the 1970s set up the ability for the World Cup to even happen in 1994 in the United States, and for MLS to even start in 1996.
That was the most important decision in my life, because I went there. We promote football in the United States. Today, football in the United States, soccer, is a bigger and more organized than Brazil, than all over the world. I am proud for that.
Pelé's arrival was sort of the generational kickstart that led to that, the same way the 94 World Cup was the generational kickstart that led to the renaissance that soccer is experiencing right now.
You know, it does occur to me when we talk about how he was a forerunner of so many things, soccer in America, and also just like the template for what it is to be a modern global sports star. It also feels safe to say that, like, in his later years, the guy sold a lot of stuff, man. Like, he was a friend of capitalism.
Yeah. He sold a lot, Pablo, like a lot. You know, it feels, if you look back at it, like if you were to make a list, it sometimes feels ridiculous. You know, I mean, he got paid. Oh, first of all, he recorded his own music, which, by the way, was playing kind of on a loop during the 24-hour week in the stadium at Vila Belmiro, which was a little difficult. I mean, if you were there for any extended period of time, it's a little difficult to sort of hear the same, like, one song over and over and over.
Another way he was ahead of his time, athletes recording their own songs.
And a one-hit wonder in a lot of ways too. But I mean, he was on TV, he was in a soap opera, he advertised for Puma, he advertised for Pepsi, he advertised for MasterCard. Pablo, I know this is a family-friendly production, but he was right at the forefront of the erectile dysfunction medication revolution. I mean, this guy was a pitchman for Viagra. You know, he did hair things. He did jewelry things. Look, he came from poverty. He had struggled with his finances. There was no doubt that he was very cognizant of money and wanted to, you know, do good in the world, but also get paid for doing that good.
And it also has the effect of changing how the younger generation, again, who we are trying to help out here, views this man. I remember going to the World Cup with you, Sam, in Brazil in 2014 and seeing him, you know, selling Subway sandwiches.
Yes.
You know, again, like, of course. But the point is, he was somebody who was that guy in the commercial as much as he was, by the end of his life, that guy in that highlight reel.
Yeah, there's no doubt. And I think, look, Pablo, you know, it's easy to sort of feel like, oh, he did too much. It was ridiculous. Like you said, the subway thing or the Viagra thing or whatever. I mean, you know, the bottom line is like athletes today do it all the time. I mean, Messi had his name linked to a blockchain, you know, entity at one point. Yes. Like, you know, I'm not sure how that's going to look in terms of, you know, historical choices or whatever. But my point
is a bit on bad. But yeah.
My point is only that, like, to me, the business part of it was never really the thing. Honestly, I think that when you look at what Pelé did to his legacy, I think the larger questions come from the more significant, the more meaningful issues, you know. Mm. Did he...
Like what? What are you thinking of on that front?
Yeah, I think that there are fair criticisms and questions about how Pelé dealt with political issues and with societal issues, like we talked about before. You know, Pablo, this week, right, I met up with a woman named Didi Diaz, and she is a 66-year-old retired professor, and she has worked as an activist in Brazil with feminist groups, with anti-racism groups for her entire life. And Dita was telling me that she is feeling awkward because everybody is lionizing Pelé in the, you know, aftermath of his death. And she gets it. I mean, Pelé obviously is a huge figure in Brazilian culture, but she feels conflicted. And there are a number of Brazilians, she says, who feel conflicted. And a lot of it has to do with the fact that he was a black man playing a white sport and having incredible success. And that's amazing. That's inspirational for so many people in so many ways. And Pelé did any number of positive things in terms of representing both Brazilians, black people, athletes. He embraced higher education. He went back to college and got a degree, which not many of his contemporaries did. But Dito was saying that he didn't speak out at any point in his career, at any point in his life, really. He didn't speak out and use his platform to speak to the anti-racism movement. He just didn't, you know? It was one of those things where he went along with the establishment line, which is that racism isn't a problem in Brazil. And if it is, it's a small one that if you shine a light on it, all you're doing is making it more likely it's going to happen again.
Yeah, I'm kind of getting echoes almost of like a Republicans buy sneakers too kind of a dynamic here, where you have this global superstar, Michael Jordan in the one hand, Pelé on the other, where people from his own background wish he had done more to speak directly for them.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that, you know, this is what Dita said. She was like, you know, he would say, I suffered because I was poor, which he was, but he never would say I suffered because I was black, even though it was very clear that he did. I mean, when he got to Santos as a teenager, he was sometimes called gasolina, you know, which is a reference to petroleum, to oil, right? And obviously his skin. When he became a star player in the 60s, Dita told me that he tried to join the very popular Santos Tennis Club, but it was all white and they wouldn't let him in. This is the biggest star in the city and they wouldn't let him in. So like, that's what she was saying, that it was clear he's lived in so many ways the lives that black Brazilians have lived, but didn't speak to that shared experience in any meaningful way. And I think in a lot of ways, Pablo, that left a certain segment of the population feeling as though he fell short.
You seem to be describing, Sam, somebody who was so broadly popular, so again, so much the most famous man in the world, that he really took pride in wanting to keep like his fan base together. He seemed bipartisan in aspiration.
Yeah, there's no doubt. Let me tell you a story, Pablo, that Dita told me. You know, in 1978, there was another Brazilian soccer player who was a big goal scorer. His name was Ronaldo, and he celebrated his goals by raising his fist like the Black Panthers did. He wanted to support the Black Panthers, and that display really angered the Brazilian military dictatorship. They weren't happy with that. They essentially told him, hey, we'll do the politics. You know, you just play soccer. And Ronaldo pushed back. And ultimately, he was left off the roster in 1982. You know, technically, I think they said, oh, he was injured. He wasn't injured. They just didn't want him on the team. And so, you know, when Dita was telling me this story, she was saying, like, that's an example, right? This is a player who used that platform, made a statement, and had to suffer the consequences. And I think she feels as though Pelé was always driven by this idea, I can't lose what I've got. I need to do whatever I can to hold on to what I've got. And she wishes, I think, that he would have been willing to risk it, but he simply wasn't.
Football is the most important production of the Brazil. Don't gonna mix sport with the political. We understand, we need good education, we need school, we need the hospital, I understand. But we need a stadium to play to. Football make Brazil big.
And so by the end, in terms of now, the present tense, the later stages of his life, his final days, what do we know about his death?
I don't know if you remember this, but at that World Cup in Brazil in 2014, there were some questions about Pelé's health. And then in 2018 at the World Cup in Russia, there were stories about how he was in really poor health and his health was failing. And, you know, it was a thing. And then obviously during this World Cup, it happened again. Pelé's in poor health. He's in the hospital. You know, he's under serious doctor care 24 hours a day. He'd been treated for cancer, a couple different kinds of cancer, I think, in recent years, and had battled infections, different types of respiratory problems. The main illness that he was battling was colon cancer. And it was one of those things where, because it had been this sort of long-running saga, and because the family had been very quick to say, like, no, he's better, he's okay, it's okay. When I was in Qatar, I didn't spend a lot of time thinking about it because it felt very similar to what had happened in Russia. And so I think that, you know, when the news came that he had died on December 29th, I'm not going to say that I was surprised because, look, he was 82, he was sick. But I think it was one of those things where nobody in the soccer world was quite ready for it, because it was something that we'd been sort of getting ready for a long time, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, we've never known a world without Pelé until now. This is the unprecedented territory that sports finds itself in. We are inhabiting a world that he shaped, and now he's gone, Sam. And so as you're in Brazil right now, as you were just there, amid the celebration and the funeral, the mourning and the party, how do you think Brazil is going to remember him? How should we remember this man?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked it kind of two ways there, Pablo, because I think that there are two parts to it, right? I mean, for someone like you, for somebody like me, I think we're like the average soccer fan, right? We love this game. We love this sport. And so because of what Pelé means to this sport, it's impossible not to feel some kind of a connection. It's impossible not to think, hey, this guy created the modern football superstar. This guy created what it means to be famous in a global way. And that matters. That's meaningful. And so whatever you think of the rest of his life, that is a big part of his legacy. And for someone like you or for someone like me, that's a big part of what we'll remember. But the thing that makes me so happy that I came to Santos this week is that it is a different kind of an answer to that question when you're talking about people who are here. On Monday morning, Pablo, I got up at 3:15 a.m. and I went from my hotel here to the Vila Belmiro Stadium in the center of the city. By the time I got there, it was dark. Most of the, you know, lights in the houses were off. Everybody was sleeping. But at the stadium, there was a few dozen fans who were waiting, just standing there in this traffic circle right by the stadium, waiting. Because Pelé's body was being transported from the hospital where he died in Sao Paulo to Santos, and he was going to arrive any moment. And then all of a sudden, Pablo, I look up and I look at the end of the street and I see 6, 7, probably teenage 20-something boys running with giant white flags. They're waving Santos flags. And then a few seconds later, fireworks start going off. And not like little fireworks, not like, you know, pop gun fireworks, you know, that you would see like July 4th. Like massive fireworks, like red and white lights, yeah, exploding in the sky. And I kid you not, Pablo, like every light in the bedroom of every house on the street kind of flips on all in unison. Everybody's like just jolted awake, you know? The windows are opening. People are poking their heads out the window. These fireworks are just blasting, you know, lights everywhere. There's a helicopter overhead now flashing a searchlight. And all of a sudden, a convoy of cars makes this turn onto the street and comes towards us. There were 50 people there at most watching this car take Pelé's body into the stadium, but they were there to watch Pelé come home. You know, this is a guy who belonged to the world. He belonged to everybody who loved soccer, but he didn't belong to anybody more than he belonged to the people in Santos, and they wanted to see him come home. And so they came out at 4 o'clock in the morning. They shot fireworks off into the air. They sang as the hearse pulled into the stadium, and they welcomed Pelé back home.
Sam Borden, our correspondent that we export all over this planet, thanks for joining us, man.
Thanks very much, Pablo. Always great to be with you.
I'm Pablo Torre. This has been ESPN Daily, and I'll talk to you tomorrow.